Hey there, welcome to the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. My name is Kevin Devan, I'm the Total Connector. I'm so super excited to have Jeff Booth on my show. I've read his book, The Price of Tomorrow, Why Deflation is the Key to an Abundant Future. His background is really fascinating. He's got like 20 years experience building up, you know, like a half a billion market cap company. And he's on the board of so many technological companies, and his book is just amazing. I read it like three times and wrote down like eight pages of quotes and questions I have, and because not even the book of the excellent book of Sahir Amuz, even though it's really excellent, it couldn't answer me all those questions, because this is what I always envision, like what could the world, our future human civilization look like on a monetary root layering of Bitcoin, you know, the hardest, scarcest, soundest money, decentralized, distributed ledger, you know, and really a sound, logical, ethical money. What could the world look like? And this is, you know, where it comes to the practicality, like, the process of how we can achieve this. So eventually, yeah, deflationary technology is already here, and because we're paying, less and less, or even free, it's actually a lot of things are free actually already. So if you just expand it into other sectors of technology, with transportation, energy, all these technologies that are just either, in the closets or under the hood, or, the name of national security, patent system, or what have you. So it's the root of this whole thing is, as he says himself, Jeff Booth says, he calls it a Ponzi scheme, and I call it just, a criminal monetary economical system, untouchable, criminally immune central banks. Anyway, without further ado, not going into a rant now, but hope you're going to love this. Let me know your questions, your comments. Afterward, thanks so much for listening and for support. Without further ado, this is my talk with Jeff Booth, the author of The Price of Tomorrow, Why Deflation is the Key to an Abundant Future. Make sure you follow him.
Hey, Jeff. How are you doing?
Thanks so much for your time and welcome to the show.
Thanks.
All right. Jeff, I'm going to try to give my best, because you've got a really fascinating background. Just a brief overview, sort of your biography. So you came out, you were one of the front leaders, visionary leaders when it comes to e-commerce, information technologies, and all kinds of other technologies. And you've been co-founder of so many companies. You're sitting on the board of a lot of think tanks or entrepreneurial think tanks, I would call them, and companies. You were also featured in a lot of mainstream news outlets like Forbes and even named as one of the 100 most intriguing entrepreneurs. So maybe you could give my listeners a little bit deeper dive. How you came to write this book, and what does deflation really mean?
Okay, so I wrote the book because it's sitting at the front seat of technology, and lots of friends in the technology field and AI field, and so it's a network that I'm very familiar with, and love what's going on, how fast the world's changing, how fast really great entrepreneurs are seizing on opportunities to make the world better, right? That's what they're doing. They're not setting up businesses to try to hurt people. They're setting up businesses to try to make the world better. But when I looked at it in a narrow view, I love every one of the companies I'm involved with. But when I would broaden that perspective and I look at in a broad view and what's in a world view, I realized that this can't work with the existing economic system because it's deflationary, and the existing economic system is inflationary. So you have two opposing forces trying to fight each other, and it's breaking, those opposing forces are breaking society. So, so I'll go into your second question. If you think about inflation or deflation, deflation is when your money gets more valuable, goods and services get lower in cost, And inflation is the opposite. Your money gets less valuable, and things get more expensive. And so it's worth just pausing on that instead of grabbing the emotion that we normally attach to that word, because we've been taught deflation is bad, right? We grew up in economics and everything else. Deflation is a bad thing. You want to avoid it at all costs. So it's worth saying, why is my money getting more valuable a bad thing, right? It's not. Different winners, different losers. If you hold cash and you have an inflationary environment, your money's getting worthless, then you shouldn't hold cash. You should buy assets, and vice versa. So just worth pausing and having listeners think about that for a second, and then the consequences. And so the consequences are, if you're in an inflationary environment, and you own real estate, real estate will go up as cash is the value of your money goes down. If you're in a deflationary environment, everything's going to follow. Your cash is worth more. So we've grown up in an inflationary environment. So of all the policymakers, all of the models look back at an inflationary environment. And technology creates everything cheaper. It's a deflationary environment. And there's nothing that governments can do short of debasing their currencies to stop it. It's too great a force.
Well, yeah, exactly. I love your book, Jeff. It's amazing. I mean, some of the answers is exactly what I've been actually waiting for, or in connection with with the whole content. I've been trying to go deeper into the rabbit hole with a lot of other guests when it comes to Bitcoin, like, because you've really in a really eloquent and visionary way, really went down to the root causes of, first of all, that this whole monetary economical system is for the pre-technological era, right? So could you, because I've got like 8 pages of questions over here, but I'm going to do it like one by one. And maybe if we have time at the end, I'm going to go a little bit deeper. So you talk about first in the chapter, a call to action about the monopolies or monopoly companies that, you raise the question, are they going to be relevant at all in the future? And you have very legitimate question, like how we're going to transition, in terms of long-term thinking. And then you, if I may quote you, you say the rules by which we all play, the game, alluding to governments and central banks, and a false choice from frameworks built for a time before technology when the world operated differently. And then you talk about debt, the whole debt infused, the debt system will need to be totally restructured or, transformed. Can you go a little bit deeper? Like, what are the fundamental transformational requirements that we need? Especially when you talk about, like, you raise like a really good question, like, what if the governments, do we need to wait like until the governments permitted, like give us the permission? Do we need the permission for that?
So you've gone in a whole bunch of different tangents there, but that's okay. But I'll start with, if you artificially decrease interest rates to drive inflation, right? So if governments at all costs, monetary easing, low interest rates, now to negative interest rates in most parts of the world, negative real interest rates. US is going to go negative interest rates and significantly negative interest rates, but so is everyone. If you warp capitalism by doing that, the incentive structure to hold cash is really bad, right? Because you're destroying the cash value. So what they think they're doing is trying to drive growth. And how many years do you need to hear central banks saying we can't get inflation up to believe they can't, right? It's 25 years now that they've been trying the same. And the result of all that effort has added $185 trillion of debt to drive $46 trillion of economic growth. Most of that debt is going into asset prices, right? And it's all connected, because you've created an incentive structure not to hold cash, right? Which gets it to spend, which increases debt at a crazy rate. And even the debt alone, forget the technology for a minute, it's a way bigger driving force, but even the debt alone, if you assume the debt has to be paid back, which it does, right, unless you debase your currency, if you assume the debt has to be paid back, then that's a drag alone on future growth, because the taxes have to go up significantly to pay back the debt. Right. And that reduces money to be able to pay for into growth. It's no difference if it's you or me. If you take a whole bunch of money and borrow a whole bunch of money, you can look really rich in the short term. You can hire gardeners and you can build new houses and everything else. And if you can't pay that back, then you go into bankruptcy. Or if you can pretend, if you can get another loan to pay some of it back, and then that's all we're doing. So we're pulling demand forward massively, which has to be paid back at some point. Why? What's happening now? And you're hearing MMT, and you're hearing all sorts of kitchen sink crazy ideas.
Negative interest rates.
Right. MMT. Like, how far past the point of rescue do you need to be to realize that this is, if an economic system requires bailouts every number of years, MMT, negative interest rates, everything else, can't you see the patient's already dead? Right. But now, the opposite side of the problem. With that much debt in the world before COVID, over $250 trillion of known debt. There's way more in unfunded
liabilities.
Liabilities, derivatives, all of China, everything else. It's just so many.
Quadrillion.
Exactly. It's staggering. Against a world economy that was $80 trillion and now it's a lot smaller, right? And so that's before. The debt just exploded, or it's going to explode a lot more and the economy is lower. At what point does it just look like a Ponzi scheme? And governments realizing it, saying, oh my God, we need more debt to solve the problem we created in the first place, right? Doesn't sound very logical. But on the other side of this, if you allow deflation, if you allow nature to take its course, what's going to happen anyways?
Mm-hmm.
The debt explodes in real terms, right? So imagine you making less and less each year, but your mortgage stays the same. Your mortgage gets way more expensive to pay, right? Now, all the costs of the other things in your life come down each year as well, right? Mm-hmm. But your mortgage or the debt explodes in real terms. So that's what governments are trying to stop, because it's a reset button of the entire financial system, especially if you do it in a disorderly way. But at this pace, it's going to happen in a disorderly way at some point in the future anyways. So, I wrote the book kind of, and I think if you think about your children, my children, and next generation people coming up, they're going to live with these consequences, and their world won't look like the one we grew up with, and with all of the opportunities and choice and everything else, because we're pushing all of that, paying for that.
I'm not sure I understand.
Oh, sorry. Siri's on. but we're pushing all of that into the future, and it's and I wrote the book hoping we could have an orderly transition to that future, that the future could look really abundant instead of the path we're on.
I wish that every student, every kid, at least from a certain age on, should read this book, Jeff, and with all honesty. The book is called The Price of Tomorrow, Why Deflation is the Key to an Abundant Future. And let me tell you something, because you probably, I don't know, have you read the book of Safed Anamous, The Bitcoin Standard? Yeah, okay, so on page, I think it's somewhere 96 to 98, and I asked this over and over to a lot of guests, but you're the first one who's really going exactly into the core, issues of, what kind of future could possibly realistically await us as a society, individual, civilization. I think people cannot wrap their heads around that we can have a totally, evolutionary civilization on a scientific, technological, social, economical, and spiritual level, even. This is a you know, Bitcoin podcast show. So with the hardest and scarcest money, which as you say in your own book, it is decentralized or distributed. It's uncontrollable. It's you know, it has all the monetary properties that we would need. Do you want to like, you know, dive deeper into like, why do you think Bitcoin could be, I mean, from your perspective, the ultimate maybe candidate for, you know, for a new deflationary world economic
system? Let's first talk about some of the what could happen with deflation, right? What could happen with deflation? Because a lot of people are scared to death of it, right? And it's who wins, who loses, right? It's but deflation alone. When John Maynard Keynes wrote his famous essay in 1930 that said, it was called "The Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren." He predicted at this time that we would be working 15-hour work weeks, mm-hmm. and until 1970. We were on a trend that looked exactly like that. So he looked at all the technology advances and he forecasted them forward on an exponential trend, not on a linear trend. And a lot of people take his work and they maybe in the Bitcoin community, don't know he's the father of Keynes and economics, right? And so, but a lot of what he was saying, he forecasted well. The 15-hour work week has changed because we've debased currency and we've driven money into the hands of some and taken it from others. That's what's happened, right? Because we went off the gold exchange and because every country is manipulating their currency. And it starts slowly and then it speeds up and they have to manipulate more and more. And that's what's happening all over the world right now. And it doesn't matter. So if China is going to drive currency values down so they can increase their layer, so they can keep people working, right? Then, and we buy more from China, right? And then everybody in China knows, oh my God, my currency is going to be devalued. I need to get my money out of China and I need to put it in real estate or something like that. You can see the folly of this, right? It's created warped incentives and everything else all over the world because what is the value of money? And we're distorting that. We're distorting that underneath. There is no fixed exchange all over the world, and that is the cause of what we're talking about. Why people aren't working 15 hours and having a lot of free time is technology has done more of the work because we've enriched some artificially and taken from some artificially, and so. So if you look forward, why do you need to, so first, let's say, if governments are, think of what they're doing, you're propping up asset prices naturally, right? That should fall, bailouts, taking Fed money off balance sheets that would have priced the system properly again, things would have fallen like crazy. And the people with cash would have bought those assets for pennies in the dollars and they would be the new wealthy, right? Instead, you've propped up prices unnaturally by all of these kitchen sink type of items. And then on that very other side, because you pick the pocket of savers and you pick the pocket of a whole bunch of fixed income people, you have to go in and develop social programs for them to pay for higher asset prices that wouldn't be there unless you created them in the first place. That's where we are, right? It seems logical to me that if you just let things fall to their natural course, capitalism would work perfectly, right? Things would fall, the people who wanted to work more would work more, they would take more of the pie, just not an egregious level of the pie right now that's been artificially gifted to them. They would be creating value and prices would fall along the natural trajectory that they should because of technology. Who's gonna give up their smartphone? This smartphone was only invented 13 years ago, mm-hmm. and it's all free. Everything on it is free. The more things that are run by technology, the more price drops. I don't buy a camera anymore. I don't buy a guitar tuner anymore. I don't buy a whole bunch of things anymore. It's all on my phone.
But we don't have a free market capitalism, right? Which you say in your book also, we don't have one. So what do we need to do in order to create, with, could that be Bitcoin? Is Bitcoin
capitalism? That's why, and I've said this on a couple of other Bitcoin shows, I love the community, right? But some in the community, like, burn it down, right? Mm-hmm. I would, and I'd be careful about burn it down, right? A better transition to Bitcoin would be if governments actually started adopting it, moved to it, and we transition there rather than, because if we have a disorderly unwind to Bitcoin, which could easily happen, which is actually the most probable course, if we have a disorderly unwind to Bitcoin, holding Bitcoin is going to be dangerous too, because the society is going to be, it's just going to upend society so brutally. And if you think about what that looks like, that's not a very, very fun society to be living in either. A lot of times people project only one dimension, their dimension of what Bitcoin looks like, instead of the second order effects and everything else. So I think it's important to, it would be way better for all the Bitcoin people to get together with the gold people to say, we all believe in the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. We believe money needs to be attached to something that's that can't be manipulated. You believe it in gold. So with gold, I think the only reason gold is worth it, call it an $8 trillion, $7.5 trillion market cap, is because it used to be fixed to money, right? It's not because of jewelry. And there's many that believe that it will be pegged to money again. I don't think either.
No.
I think it was the best of the time.
So, but it failed, right? I mean, exactly. Centralization or whatever, you know, how do you assay the validity, the authenticity of the gold? It's a lot of, you know, problems and flaws, and which I think has been proven now.
But again, there's a whole bunch of people with a belief, and that in it, and it worked for a long time, and it actually made the world, it made world trade better, and then it failed for the same reasons you're talking about. And there's a lot of people that believe that it's going back there again because it worked for a time. So that, if you believe that, and gold will probably go a lot higher from here, right? But Bitcoin is about what now? $130-140 trillion market cap. So if you look at the asymmetric bet on Bitcoin, how much upside versus downside, I cannot believe more people aren't in it. They should be putting money in it in a big way, even if it's to protect wealth, 10% of your portfolio. Right. If it's to gain wealth, a lot more than that, right? Now, there's risk on it too. But if I look at first principles of the whole thing and I say, what is likely to happen? What is likely to happen is governments keep doing what they're doing. And at some point, if that happens, then there's going to be massive damage economically, socially, everything else. And people are going to look for a trusted medium of exchange. And you can see this happening in other areas. You can see Venezuela, right? Venezuela had 1.8% interest last year. At the same time, Bitcoin lost 30% of its value. I would rather lose 30% than 1.8%, right? And then now Bitcoin's way up again. So, and all the people that had Bitcoin in Venezuela could eat. They could transfer their cross borders. They could, so it saved families. It saved people. Do you think those people will ever be off Bitcoin? Right. And so as that happens, more and more come into it. It works on a network effect and it becomes a trusted medium. And at some point, I think governments have to peg to it. So I think the upside is staggering. It'll still, because of the pressure of miners to sell and because of the incentive structures baked into it, which are brilliant, it'll still fluctuate a bunch right now as we go through the halving. But long term, it's I see it most likely being the new reserve currency.
Mm-hmm. The conditions right now, if we just look around, it's mind boggling. I mean, we got 30 million unemployed now, United States. we got is, you know, you mentioned Venezuela. I read again something about Lebanon. You know, we're gonna probably do a talk about this with some other insiders who have a little bit more insight into Lebanon or Iran. I'm originally from Iran. I was born there, but I grew up in Austria and in the States. And then, you know, there's this talk about UBI, universal basic income, and I'm like, do we really need universal? Do really, you know, wouldn't actual people have much more prosperity, abundance, and, you know, super low cost life and more quality of life than if they were on a UBI? What's your take on that?
Yeah, and you know, because I talk about it a bit in the book, but it's attached to this. So I'm a government. I'm going to artificially create wealth in some people, and they think they got it through national. They think they got it because of their ingenuity, and they only got it because they owned a whole bunch of assets before other people did, and they artificially made their assets more valuable. And then I need to, because I punished a whole bunch of people in that trade. Right? I picked the pocket of a whole bunch of people who now can't get the assets, can't afford the assets, and have to pay higher rents on those assets to be able to live. So I put a whole bunch of people in stress because of that trade. And then UBI said, I'm going to keep doing that. Right? I'm doing that right now. Right now, that's what we're doing. And then a whole bunch of people are rising up with pitchforks because they can't eat. And then I'm going to go and tax those people at the top to be able to create UBI to pay up a sum to the people on the bottom, to pay for falsely high asset prices. It's insanity.
And what are the wealthy people going to do? I mean, there's this jurisdiction arbitrage. They're going to, you know, if they can, I mean, it, you know, as long as it's possible, then, you know, escape to another, you know, offshore, you know, just.
But that's the problem all over the world. You're seeing the same thing. You're seeing this, like there is, that's actually why I said, as far as Bitcoin, you want an orderly transition. You want governments to understand this, or the new governments that replace them to understand this and figure out the path to transition to this, to an abundant future. Because if you don't, it won't be one place in the world. Like it's going to happen everywhere. It's going to be it's going to be a real mess. And for populations everywhere that are left out, there will no. I hate talking about this on podcasts, but I will. What did Nazi Germany look like under Hitler? Yeah. And effectively, all he did is targeted the people who owned the assets, right? And he created an enemy, because it's easy to create an enemy when people are feeling like it's not their fault; it's somebody else's fault. So politicians, right now, you can see this starting to happen all over the world. Right, politicians are creating internal enemies to be able to galvanize their base. And when you don't have a big enough, so it looks like. Create internal enemy to be able to get in power. Create when you don't have a big enough internal enemy, you need an external enemy, right? And so that path forward on existing path by effectively fighting gravity, right? Central banks fighting gravity, which they will not win. Technology is too powerful a force in the end, is creating all sorts of damage.
So divide and rule is, again, you know, just the same script in a different color, right? I mean,
yeah, this all sounds really dark, and it is dark on our existing path. I can't say it, but that why I had to go through some of these things in the book is because if you don't understand them and you think everything's great, then you probably won't change, right? Mm-hmm. And so a whole bunch of people need to step up right now and lead this message, because our future could look totally different. It could be abundant. It could be fantastic.
We can't even imagine, probably, right? I mean,
we can't even imagine.
We want to talk to you about this, like about the other technologies, because I know, I'm sorry, Jeff, to interrupt, but I know your focus is on, let's say, you know, specific information technologies, computer technologies, commerce technology. But I mean, you touch upon it in the book, but I wanted really to have a deeper dive with you. Like, there's so many technologies out there, whether you know they're in the closet or you know secured somehow by the patent system or not. I mean, if I just look at some technologies that are just publicly accessible or visible, like whatever you know, we can see all those videos from Boston Dynamics, robot technologies. I mean, at the end of the day, these technologies should be serving us humanity. Do you see like a world where all these technologies going to come out of the closets and be really, you know, develop, mass produce and serve us people? Transportation, you know, transportation, energy, all these things, you know?
So yes. And I went through a whole bunch of them in the book and the logical consequence of those things coming out. And you could go through the timeframes of some of those. I'm close to, so most of those in Boston Dynamics, the case, let's say that technology, which will come out, it's just too costly for mass adoption right now. But the price keeps falling and falling and falling. And at some point it goes just like the Palm Pilot was not a right fit till the iPhone, and then the iPhone takes off, smartphone takes off. It's the same analog. And we look backwards on technology when technology is moving exponentially forwards. I just happen to have a front seat at that. I see what's happening in AI really closely. One of the top AI researchers, I'm helping him form a business. And it's not on deep learning, it's on probabilistic programming, which might be the next level of artificial intelligence. And if you knew how fast this was moving and what could happen with it, and if you sat in the front seat of some of these meetings and see what's happening, it's already happening. It's happening at a rate that people can't fathom, and it's moving across society. So it's exciting because and I've said this quite often, but the air you breathe is free, right? Mm-hmm. And it's free because it's abundant. And you can only charge for air underwater, and maybe you could charge for air if we pollute air so badly that. But you can only charge for scarcity, abundance, scarcity or perceived scarcity. Brands try to create perceived scarcity or. But abundance is free. Look at oil prices, what that just happened. And so technology creates that abundance everywhere, right? And it drives and artificial intelligence powered into some of this technology doesn't require the same amount of jobs, and it does a better job, right? It gives you more if you think about drug discovery, if you think about healthcare system, if you think about all of these things that we have not even touched. Mm-hmm. That it's moving at lightning speed, and you add up what's going to happen to economies. Right now, $185 trillion, by the way, before COVID, whatever the number is going to be after COVID, is looking backwards. Looking forward, deflation has just started. Right, abundance has just started. Mm-hmm. Looking forward, it touches every single industry, and at blinding speed.
Let me talk to you about Bitcoin again, because I want to know your position, like, or your vision, how we could implement this seriously. I mean, my girlfriend has her own company or shop. She works literally every day, 7 days a week. And she says, yeah, she would definitely implement, if it was user friendly, an alternative, you know, optional alternative opt-in payment system. You know, you touch upon that, you know, you pretty described that pretty well, that, you know, we're not ready yet for sort of scalable whatever payment technologies when it comes to Bitcoin, but we have already, you know, a lot of internet applications, but it needs time. I mean, you know, people don't have the time to sit like me, you know, like 1-3 days, set up a full node, you know, this and that application. So it's not, yeah, I get it. It's not, you know, it's got to be as you say, you know, it's a exponential technology. But would you say that it could be a cool strategy to, you know, help the small businesses, just starting with the small business, the merchants, the shop owners, the small businesses or mid-sized, whatever, give them like, you know, form a special task force, help these people at least be prepared once the transition comes, once, you know, the shit hits the fan. And after, you know, as you said in your book, that like you're kicking the can down the road, you know, at least people are ready to transact, to trade with Satoshis, yeah, with Bitcoin. I mean, that's the only viable, realistic scenario I have in my head, how we can literally, effectively implement sort of a strategy.
So there's on-ramps, off-ramps into fiat currency that you could do immediately, right? Mm-hmm. So that would work as well. In fact, that might actually even be better in the short term, because it would get more people understanding what it is. So you're talking about Bitcoin being a currency, and I'm talking about Bitcoin being a reserve currency. Mm-hmm. So everything pegged to currency. Could it be a currency as well? Yes, but a lot of things need to happen to be a currency, and I don't know if it needs to be. I would hope. I think what is likely to happen as this progresses is at some point as other countries fail, they're gonna band together and they're gonna say this makes no sense and we need to peg to something, and they're gonna peg to something like Bitcoin, and if one does two, it's just going to accelerate from there. That's what so you have a whole bunch of community that's doing it, and then you have countries that start to do it, and it becomes a reserve status, and whether that reserve status is a peg to a currency, mm-hmm, or currency itself, it doesn't matter.
Right. Do you think there would be like a sort of a tipping point where, you know, let's say businesses start thinking, hey, why do we, you know, why are we transacting with a medium exchange that is, or with a currency that is, you know, potentially, you know, as we see things unfolding, inflationary, even hyperinflationary, you know,
that's what happened in Venezuela, right? Mm-hmm. That's why Bitcoin was valuable, and truthfully US dollars became valuable there too. That's actually why it was so valuable. That's why in Lebanon right now, I think it's Lebanon, that Bitcoin is a way higher price than it is in everywhere else, right?
Yeah,
because it's so valuable there that that doesn't make sense on a decentralized node, but the on-road, off-road there charges a way higher fee,
right? The premiums.
premium, because it's in value.
Right. So let me go to some other questions. You wrote in the chapter, who's controlling the money, the reset of, you talk about the reset of debt, that you described that, I don't know the quote right now, but somehow it's not avoidable anymore. Like,
yeah, I don't think, so with deflation, especially if you allow deflation, it's unavoidable. So at some point, mm-hmm, there's going to be, there has to be a reset. And that reset could happen disorderly or orderly. And that reset could happen in a number of ways. Like a reset of debt. If you take the Weimar Republic, when they couldn't repay their debt, they turned on the printing presses at full, mm-hmm, full steam. And that created wheelbarrows full of money to buy bread, and that created the rise of Hitler. So the reset could look like hyperinflation, and then on the other side. But at some point, it doesn't matter anyway. So as you go through this, it's going to be deflationary at some point anyways, right? The long-term trend is going to be, so you can drive inflation just by debasing your currency aside, like if you do it enough. When you talk about these debt numbers, it's so far, like think about these numbers versus the economy, and then think about how high they're going right now. At some point, how many zeros do you want to add on to it to believe that it can't be paid back? Right? To believe you're like, that it's a fairy tale, everything. And if that's the case, it really looks like a Ponzi scheme, right?
Yeah.
Don't buy bonds at the last minute. Don't be the last one into the bond market and everything else, because at some point, as everyone's heading for the exits, you won't get out.
Yeah. And well, to be honest with you, I mean, Ponzi scheme is still for me an understatement. I mean, if people just understood, like Henry Ford said, you know, if people just understood how money is created, something like that banking system, they would go on the streets and, you know, trigger a revolution. And you also talk about, you know, controlling the value of money, to quote you here, can lead to the abuse of power, especially you know, if the currencies underlying other currencies and really went into debt, like, and then you wrote also, since global debt is already so high and expanding quickly, a reset of debt is needed in any truly viable solution. And then you go, you know, what I really love about, like, what's the background of Bretton Woods, at least it was somehow pegged the dollar to the gold and all the other currencies to the dollar. So the more I think about it, it's like we got to solve this, you know, all these symptoms. You know, we're living in a world where we have super centralized, untouchable structures, whether it be, you know, central banks, Bank for International Settlements, the governmental structures, the military industrial corporate complex. It's really a matrix. Like, where do you see this going? I mean, do you think we have the luxury of time? You know, because there's some Bitcoiners that's like, hey, we have time, we have decades of time. Do you really need decades of time?
So you know that I've been so the book came out before this all happened, right? But I talked about in the book that it doesn't matter where the next crisis comes from, right? Because it's like popping a pin in the balloon and you see the truth everywhere. So COVID is just an accelerating event. And I'll give you an example here, because this is all connected. So I'll use commercial real estate as an example. So 10 million users on Zoom, what we're on right now, a month and a half ago, is now 300 million users on Zoom. For Zoom, they didn't hire hundreds of thousands of new employees to keep up with that growth. It's all digital in nature, and we do that work. And so our cost of the work has just come down, has plummeted. And so if you believe that when COVID is over, 300 million users is going back to 10 million, then Zoom will fall in value and commercial real estate will go through a V-shaped recovery. Right? If you don't believe that, and I don't see any possible evidence that it goes back to 10 million, right? Because a lot of people will go, wait, this working from home thing is actually not bad. And I don't need all of these offices, and I don't need to drive 2 hours a day into back and forth. I can actually get more done with less time and more time for my family. If you believe that, and let's say Zoom goes from 300 million to 200 million, then there's 100 million, there's 200 million people, 190 million people who aren't renting office space anymore. And if they're not renting office space anymore, then commercial office real estate, and that's one video conferencing company times everyone that's going through the similar thing. If they're not renting office space anymore, commercial space has to come down a lot, right? And commercial rents, and then rents have to follow, and you get deflation there. You get deflation there, and the banks own commercial real estate, or hedge funds, or who's ever owning the commercial real estate. Some of them will be insolvent because they have loans against that commercial real estate and the new rents don't pay for the loan.
Right.
So it's so connected all together, and why the governments are trying to prop up commercial real estate, even leverage loans, everything else, because if it falls to its natural order, which it has to fall to its natural order from what we just talked about, if you just follow the trail, then it's massively deflationary. Massively deflationary. And so you have to create more money out of thin air to try to bail that out, and it's just a house of cards.
Oh my God. Okay. So
that is one example, mm-hmm. but you could take that example through every single industry today. Mm-hmm. And it would look similar.
It's crazy. So all these people that, you know, sort of park their, you know, their wealth into real estate as a store of value, let's just take, I don't know, Manhattan or New York, like, what's going to happen to those real estate objects? I mean, you know, that's the
point. So that's the point. So you can imagine how many people are saying you have to protect this, right? And this is where I want to, it's not bad people on both sides.
It's incentives.
it's incentives and bad structure to create perverse incentives that requires bailouts all the time. So, and the government doesn't know they're here, right? I don't think the Fed knows that this is like, because just like Kodak didn't know the digital camera would take their business, right? Just like Blockbuster adds candy aisle to the stores instead of dealing with the first principle that Netflix growth, depending on download speeds, changes everything and it renders my business obsolete. So the natural course of action is to protect the existing instead of see how it can be. In fact, that's why entrepreneurs create so much value, because they say, this existing doesn't work. It's insane. What could it look like? And they build to what it could look like. A lot of times they're early. A lot of times they make mistakes along there, but they see a different world and they build to where it's going. So now go back to your question, what happens to real estate? Well, we've already talked about what happens to real estate. The only thing that makes that not happen to real estate is bailouts, right? Or that artificially keep real estate high, that enrich the people with real estate. Actually, it's the only thing that keeps real estate high, right? Or other countries debasing their currencies fast enough, and you get massive money flows into the U.S. to keep real estate high. But it's all coming from the same thing. It's devaluing your currency.
And it's detached from reality, Jeff, right? I mean, look at the stock market. Does it have any attachment, any reflection?
No. It doesn't have any reflection to Main Street. It has to do. But here's, I think, something to be careful of, and it would be, what I'm about to say is going to be strong on Bitcoin as well for the same reasons. Go to other examples in other countries. And this is a long way off in the US, or I think it's a long way off in the US, but who knows, in today's, there's going to be lots of changes, and the speed of those changes is going to be staggering. So things that looked good could look bad in an instant, depending on policy response. But look at Venezuela, right? When they went through a 1.8% inflation. What if you owned the best company in Venezuela? What happened if you own 20% stock in the best country? So stock price being attached to reality and the fundamental unit of measure being a currency that is going to get destroyed doesn't protect you.
Right. Oh my. So Jeff, I'm trying to find that quote, but anyway, within the context of entrepreneurship. So you're saying, you said in your book that, that considering the alternative, allowing abundance without the jobs might actually open up entirely new enlightenment era where we have the time to enjoy the benefits the technology brings. And then you say what I really love about that quote is that, but those creating value, such as, entrepreneurs, would be paid, or, I'm thinking of engineers, inventors, there's so many, ingenious people out there, would be paid for the value creation at a rate that matched the new realities of supply and demand in our digital world. Now, let me tie this in with the most important question I want to ask is, like, what I really find strange is that, I get it. Information technology has been exponentially evolving, but if we look at all the other sectors, transportation, we're still burning fuel. We have combustion engine. What kind of whatever one to many but we haven't had really zero to one technological innovations in other sectors. So I think once we have the monetary root laying, once we have a fundamental structure that is ethical, that is logical, rational, and sound. Do you think we're gonna have finally, all these technologies that will, such as transportation or?
I think it's coming anyways. All of it's coming anyways.
How fast do you think it's gonna happen? Like, it's gonna take.
So that's what I'm getting at. The speed, the rate of change. If you look at the rate of change with AI. Right. And what's happening in AI. Most people are like, you see it in your Siri search, you see it in things, you see it in, how do you think when you go to Google, do you think people are sorting those sites? It's all done with AI, right? Mm-hmm. And so you never go to page 572. You go to the first page because it always gives you the results you want, and it's all AI driven. And the things, and it's getting better and better and better. Photo quality, the facial recognition, recognition. Now you connect some of these things and what happens in ID, and then you add to data sets and you see different patterns that no one could pick up on. So the bigger the data set and the more patterns and everything else, the AI is seeing things that we can't pick up on. And so it's moving at light speed already. And that's across every industry, every category. So it's already, that's happening. Solar energy is now competing with lowest cost energy in regions of the world, right? Mm-hmm. And solar keeps going down and down and down. You could question how long that trend is, but where we are right now, let's talk about incentive structures and capitalism for a second. If solar energy is higher cost, even if you add up kind of all the damage that fossil fuels do to the environment, if solar energy is higher cost, it's almost impossible to stop countries from using lower cost energy, because it's a number one input to our economies, right? Without energy, there is no life. And it's about 10% of GDP. And if you have to pay more for energy to make your things and drive your economy, then your economy is uncompetitive. So with that lens, you look around the world, it's no wonder a military complex engages to be able to protect cheap energy. It's no wonder that energy is that valuable, because it runs our economies, and the run is, and so much about it is kind of an economic force that across the world. But that changes if solar drops lower, and it's dropping lower right now. All of the investment goes into solar, and that depresses oil prices, because now it increases the amount. Now, it doesn't have to change overnight. If it keeps coming down in price over and over and over, then the new investment, it drives a whole innovation because of the cost, that you don't need all of the other stuff. This is going to be overreaching a little bit, but a bunch of the coal will stay in the ground from now till eternity, right? So it needs the transition time. That transition time might be 50 years to be able to change energy policies and everything else. But if you just follow the trend, it's that's going to be more deflation added to all the other deflation from here, right? Because energy prices will get lower each year.
It's mind-boggling. You're at the forefront of technology. I mean, you probably talk to so many people who are really insiders. Can I ask, is there something like that could be really mind-blowing in the next years, or let's say in the next 10, 15 years, which could radically like transform the way we transport ourselves or move or, you know, fly or, you know, or whatever?
Well, I just think it's most people know some of the what's coming. Let's take self-driving cars, right, mm-hmm. as an example. What most people don't do is they don't add up the consequences or the benefits and the consequences of self-driving cars, because it's not just, so you have car companies right now that are driving production based on everybody having two cars, right? And they're forecasting their production on that angle. And self-driving cars changes that paradigm, because you don't actually drive a car. You might think you drive a car because of the way it looks and everything else. And some people would, but if you could have a car on demand whenever you wanted it, it changes the economic value of a car, right? And so maybe I'll buy that on a monthly fee, and I'll have it here whenever I want it, and I'll use that car whenever I want it. And that changes economic models drastically, and it changes the amount of cars needed. It changes insurance. It changes the amount of space needed in cities for parking for peak use all the time. So you need two spots at your house. You need two spots, garages downtown. A lot of that on a new model changes things that people don't think about when they pull together all all the other things that change because of that. Those are the bigger ones right now. There are things in the lab right now around material science, around AI on material science, that instead of steel using beams that are incredibly lightweight, that have properties that are staggering in relation. There's a lot of stuff in the lab that tied into additive manufacturing changes things. Additive manufacturing at the rate that's moving, right? It will look at some point like the Jetsons, right? And if it looks like the Jetsons and you can print anything you want in your house, first locally and then in your house, then the value of things is really like Google value of information, because it's a digital unit that can be printed anywhere. And so all of those things, and I'm involved in some of these, they are coming and I don't want to give the timeline because you can easily, but I would say it's touching so many different industries right now, and the consolidation of what happens as you consolidate data into some of this, it's staggering.
You know, Jeff, I mean, we're all trying in the Bitcoin community to inspire and educate my listeners, friends, family. I've turned myself, a lot of people within my, close environment into Bitcoiners. And I mean, there's a reason and the intention and vision behind this book, The Price of Tomorrow. So do you see I'm wishing that we could just accelerate this process. Maybe it has to do with my impatience, but I know it's possible. It's just the conditions are not right now, maybe mature enough. Maybe there's a reason for this sort of slow, gradual, but then maybe sudden process.
you sound like an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurs think the same way. Like, how do we speed this up? How do we move this forward? It's painful in the divide between seeing something and getting and moving there and building it. So the on-ramps are, it takes time. And then more and more people join that new direction, and then it just spins and it moves. That's just what it looks like, no matter what happens. What I would say is, for a lot of your listeners, it's easy to look at everybody else and say you should do it, right? Yeah, you should do this. This makes no sense, and everything else. Try to unite instead of divide. Mm-hmm. Instead of there's a lot of there are people that have their head in the sand on this, but most of them aren't bad people. They haven't looked deep enough on this. So try to use that to. There's so much division in the world right now, and the default position is division. The best leaders, the best chance of actually creating something, lead from uniting.
Right. And I listened to your interview, by the way, which I love, with Preston Pish, where you also at the end you say, how can we approach communicating, educating or opening up people? And this is also what comes really clearly out of your book, the empathy and the reason why, that's going to, with the death of your brother and your children. And so I think at the end of the day, we've got to ask ourselves, why are we doing this? What kind of world do we want to see ourselves? Do you want to share before we wrap up, what is your
vision? On that, and this is interesting. Why do you do what you do, right? And why do I do what I do and everything else? I would say the highest level is we do what we do out of love, right? We want to belong, or sort of belonging, love. And people try to get that a whole bunch of different ways, right? Most people try. And some people try to get it through power. Some people try to get it through wealth, right? If I have this much money, then I'll matter and people will care about me. If I say these things, people will care about me. It is an interesting way to live. So what is a person, if you looked at, say, a friend who's a victim, right? Who's victim mentality all the time, and they're on Facebook, what do they do, victim, oh, this happened to me, this happened to me, this happened to me. And when people stop leaning in, what does that person do? They double down, mm-hmm. right? They double down more of a victim because they're desperate for love. That's what they're after. But it's actually no different, the hero. That's what they're after too, right? So it's universal in humanity that we're all looking to belong, we all matter. It's not good or bad. It's just if you know that about yourself and you know that about humanity, you can connect the dots to help people get there and tell them the truth on where they're stopping that from happening. I used to say this in YPO, Young Presidents Organization, all the time. If you look at your calendar, you'll measure what you actually value. And so you can say, I really care about my family and this is why I'm doing this. But if your calendar is 100% work, it's hard to actually say, right? Because when you're good at work, when you're good at you get validation, right? Mm-hmm. People tell you you're good, you want to do it more. So it's important you know that. So if you buy what I just said, right? It's the same reason why people can divide people, mm-hmm. right? So because people's desperate need to belong so badly can say, hey, you and me know this, right? Those people don't know that. And people will bite every time. The higher power is to unite. The longer term power is to unite. It always has been and everything else. Short term, you can divide and you can divide and divide. Long-term unite, lean into love, lean into, and I know that's not probably something that you hear a lot of times on your Bitcoin Boss podcast, but that would be the best way to move this forward into a different, if we want abundance, if we want to drive this message home to society, that is the best way to drive it home to society, and every single person plays a role.
Right, right. And you mentioned in your book, in connection with that, you say that, people look for value, sort of belonging to a group and the career, the identity of in connection with the jobs. In a world, of abundance and prosperity, people could actually do things that maybe they've always wanted to do, whether it be creative or technological research, whatever that is, art. And I think there's a lot of people which I talked to, they say they couldn't even imagine like not having the job that they're having right now. So
that's why it's connected, Gaben. It's because they get that value from the mm-hmm. job, right? Mm-hmm. And they get that love or belonging or you matter from the job. And so, but if you actually scratch the surface, it's your if you take that down to a first principle, you can find that belonging in a whole bunch of different ways. And you could actually, you could really take humanity to a different level. If you don't have to get it from driving 2 hours to a job to be able to come back to spending all your time there. Now, if you want it from a job, if that's what you want, then great. There will still be jobs. There's tons mm-hmm. of opportunity right now as well. But what's happening in technology, it's not like jobs are going to go to zero tomorrow. It's going to be a driving trend out. And there's lots of wealth building opportunities and opportunities there.
Fantastic. Hey, Jeff, I really enjoyed our talk. It's a lot of, the insights you're giving me and your perspectives. It's, always wanted to talk to you about this. And, we've been waiting actually for this book. I've been recommending this book, your book to all, all my friends. So, I know you've also invited your readers or your followers to join you, which I really find awesome. The Price of Tomorrow platform, if I may call it. Is there any like resources you want to direct my listeners to?
Probably for now, my team is coming up with some. Here's the interesting thing: you know this from reading the book, but I didn't write the book to drive. I don't need to sell books. I did it to drive this message. In a perfect world, I wouldn't need to be the person driving the message. that a whole bunch of other people would try to drive the message, and I could just fall back into the, so I'll do whatever I need to right now. So I have a team working on some of the things that you just talked about, but for now, probably Twitter, follow me on Twitter at Jeff Booth. My website is jeffreybooth.com if you wanted to send me an email. But that's probably best for now.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Hope to, you know, have you back soon in something in the near future, and I'll be following you anyway. So keep up the great work. Really enjoyed it. Wow. All right. Bye-bye. Have a good day.
See ya.
See you. All right. It was just awesome. Fantastic. So this is what I meant is, you know, unfortunately, you know, people, humanity, because it's not their fault, it's, you know, we need to educate, we need to inspire, we need to give them the comprehension of, you know, what are the root causes, why, and what kind of, you know, huge potentials, you know, Bitcoin, starting with Bitcoin, you know, this soundest, scarcest and hardest money, decentralized and really evolutionary money could unfold, could trigger this chain reaction of you know, economical, scientific, technological, spiritual evolution and innovation, technological innovations. And, you know, we could all live in a world of abundance, prosperity, joy, pleasure, freedom. You know, at the end of the day, it's all about freedom. So thank you so much again for listening, and hope, let me know your questions. My email address is hello@thetotalconnector.com. Make sure you follow Jeff Booth on Twitter, and get, you know, you should definitely get his book, The Price of Tomorrow. Is a Kindle version. I have a Kindle version. It's I read it like 3 times because it's so thrilling. It was so deep. It was so, you know, simply written, you know, like you could literally understand what kind of civilization, what kind of tomorrow could await us. And yeah, and just follow him on Twitter, The Price of Tomorrow. And Jeff Booth is his Twitter handle, his own personal Twitter handle. And yeah, that's about it. Thank you so much for listening. My email address, again, is hello@thetotalconnector.com. You can find me on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, Telegram, what have you. And please, I would really appreciate if you give me a like, retweet, reshare, so that this information, this knowledge, this comprehension, these inspirations reach as many people as possible around the planet who speak and understand you know, English, because I'm going to try to do this also in German, at least a summary version, or talk to other people, maybe somehow exchange thoughts, knowledge, and, you know, share inspiration, and, you know, build a better world for ourselves and for our children and future children. Thank you so much again, and I'll see you soon. The Total Connector signs off.